It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out about the history of the world's largest six-pack in our Curious Wisconsin segment.
First, a bill would change how some juvenile offenders are tried in Wisconsin is gaining support in the state legislature. In a recent opinion piece, two former Wisconsin governors at the opposite ends of the political spectrum voiced their support for the bill as well.
The so-called Second Chance Bill would return nonviolent first-time 17-year-old offenders to the juvenile justice system as opposed to the adult court system. Supporters say it's the best way to rehabilitate those offenders while still holding them accountable.
Joining us now to talk about the proposed legislation is Jim Moser, Deputy Director of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, let's start by looking at the law as it stands now.
Sure.
So if a 17-year-old commits a nonviolent offense, how is that prosecuted in Wisconsin today?
Sure. Right now, any 17-year-old committing any offense, and it could be anything from a ticket, local, municipal citation for retail theft or disorderly conduct up through, you know, really any offense, gets filed or referred anyway to the adult system, and that could be an adult ticket or, in some cases, referral to the adult criminal court. And then it's up to the adult criminal court, the prosecutor, to sort of figure out how to prosecute and what kind of disposition and sentence to impose. But it's all adult, and it's all an adult record.
So if that same teenager is routed instead into the juvenile system, what happens differently?
What would happen differently is for the first time, what we're proposing is for the first time nonviolent 17-year-olds that be referred to, again, either a local, if it's a local municipal court, that it's done, treated as a juvenile, which has an impact on sort of what information is public and sort of what their record is, and oftentimes has things more appropriate for kids like community service and than necessarily fines that kids can't pay anyway. If referred to the formal court system, it would be referred to the juvenile court system, and an assessment is done and determination of whether to formally charge the youth, and if so, what kinds of services are needed to sort of get the youth back on track in the juvenile system.
Now, you think that we need to move in the direction of putting nonviolent offenders, teenagers, 17-year-olds, into the juvenile court. Why do you think we need to move in that direction?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is because we know that there are some implications and ramifications for 17-year-olds who end up with an adult record in terms of future employment, even things like access to federal student aid, things that for 17-year-olds who commit a, again, nonviolent offense, who don't have a record, ought to get a shot in, you know, getting the kind of services they need. So we also know that the services are much more readily available in the juvenile system. And there's pretty good research that shows that, you know, basically providing those kinds of services gets the youth back on track, but and ultimately has pretty significant reductions in their reoffending behavior. So
and
it's kind of good for them and good for the community.
In terms of the long-term effects on 17-year-olds who go into the adult system, what are the ramifications there?
Well, again, those records are now, given our current system, those are available online. Future employers can look at those. Landlords can look at those. And as much as we would like to think that they wouldn't hold those kinds of things against the youth, if an employer finds a 17-year-old applying for a job who has a record versus a 17-year-old who doesn't, you know, it's pretty likely they're going to take the youth who doesn't.
So you're saying this is the kind of thing that you do something at 17 and it can follow you your entire life and change the direction it might have taken.
Correct. And some of these kids will end up in the adult jail, which is certainly much riskier for youth than being held in a juvenile facility. And that record does track with them. There are provisions for getting that expunged at times. There are some courts that are more likely to do that than others. But in terms of services, things like drug and alcohol services, for instance, we have 17-year-olds in the adult system who can't legally get the services they need because they're not 18. They can't sign contracts. They can't vote. They can't do any of the kinds of things adults can do. They can't serve on a jury, but yet they could be convicted by a jury. So there's all kinds of contradictions in that. Our proposal really is meant to be, again, those first-time, nonviolent 17-year-olds who, you know, do things that are, you know, certainly can affect the community, but are not serious offenses. And our and the bill still provides that if the prosecutor believes it should be filed in adult court, they could still propose that to the court, and the youth could still be waived to adult court.
Now, in this morning's paper, there were a couple of opinion pieces by former Wisconsin governors. One was by Jim Doyle, another by Tommy Thompson. And in the case of Jim Doyle, it's an interesting one because he, in his past political career, was one of the people who helped funnel 17-year-old nonviolent offenders into the adult system. Why has he changed his mind?
Well, both of them, and certainly Governor Thompson was involved, was the one that signed the law changed in 1995 that moved 17-year-olds into the adult system. Back in starting in 96, and at that time, and Doyle, of course, was Attorney General. And both of them at the time, there were a couple things going on. One was there had been a rise in serious juvenile crime in the late 80s and early 90s that actually peaked in 94. There was a feeling that the current law at that time was too heavily weighted towards protecting juveniles. And there was a sense that the way our system was funded and resourced, the best way to sort of get it back on track was to get 17-year-olds into the adult system. Since that time, both in terms of, again, better research about which system is really more effective, and this bill, which really tries to differentiate between serious offenders and basically dumb 17-year-olds who make, who do something stupid. I think they really have just come to believe that, we've learned more about how the brain works. The research is stronger about what works, what's more effective. And this proposal still allows serious offenders to be treated in the adult system. So I think they would argue, and of course they do in what they wrote, that this is really a step that can benefit the youth and the communities.
What you just said, that's something Tommy Thompson echoes in his piece. He says, sometimes kids make poor choices, and Jim Doyle references recent brain research. I'm guessing he's talking about research on teenage brains, which points to brains that are more likely to be impulsive and be risk-taking. So in your mind, is that part of this piece here that we need to maybe understand the brain of the teenager and legislate accordingly?
Well, I think yes. I would caution I would sort of wrap around that there are 19, 20, 21-year-old, young adults who, we know that the brain isn't really that well developed in those areas until later, 23, 24, 25. So one could argue that's an issue all along, and it is. We ought to be able to find ways to assess kids and deal with them constructively, and we just think the juvenile system is better able to, more geared towards that and better able to do that. It's also much faster. I think everyone would agree that length of time is important for kids in terms of consequences and being held accountable. And we know that the juvenile system, given the way it's written and the statutory time limits that are in there, is just a much faster system than the adult system. So the cases don't linger in the juvenile system like they might in the adult system.
Now, part of the original thinking in turning 17-year-olds over to the adult court is deterrence, I'm sure. So if these same 17-year-olds, who are thinking about maybe contemplating a crime, are they more likely to do it if the 17-year-old now goes to juvenile court instead of adult court?
Well, I think again, the research, are there individual cases where that might happen? Sure. But in a sort of a general sense, the we're really talking about kids who are, again, kids who are impulsive, who are out with their peers. Most of these kids commit offenses when they're out with their friends. Somebody says, let's go do this. They kind of go along with the crowd. They're not, it's sort of by their very nature not stopping to think through the consequences of what they're doing oftentimes. And so, to sort of allude that they sit down and sort of a characteristic of them is they're not weighing the consequences one way or the other. So, sitting down individually with them when it's nice and calm, they might say that, but when they're out with their friends who kind of says, the friend says, well, let's go knock over these mailboxes, they kind of go, okay. So it's not, they don't tend to take that kind of thoughtful approach to their behavior that we hope, that we know adults do.
How does Wisconsin compare to other states in terms of legislation like this?
Wisconsin now is one of 10 states left that treat kids under 18 automatically as adults. There are, in recent years, Connecticut, Massachusetts have both changed. New York is changing, and Illinois has changed. So Wisconsin is a sort of a dwindling number of states that treat some youth under 18 automatically as adults. So, you know, hopefully we'll be one of nine, ultimately maybe one of eight, or that will, you know, we'll make our changes. But the trend around the country has, the minority of states have done this, and that minority is becoming even smaller, and Wisconsin is hopefully on the right trend.
So as we've seen, this bill has bipartisan support. What's next?
Well, we're you know, we've had a vote in an assembly committee that was unanimous and a vote in the Senate committee that was unanimous, and so we're working to get it, the political steps to get it, you know, to the floor and hopefully get it passed through both the Senate and Assembly yet here this spring. And it would take effect in January of 2015, so it provides time for counties and law enforcement and people to kind of get things geared up.
All right. Well, Jim, thank you so much for being here today.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Jim Moser is the Deputy Director of the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families.
Coming up next, we get curious. We're always at least somewhat curious anyway, but we're particularly curious about a Wisconsin landmark that's closely tied to the state's beer brewing heritage. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Well, Ohio has the world's largest basket. Minnesota has the world's largest ball of twine, evidently. And what does Wisconsin have?
Something even better, the world's largest six-pack. And nobody knows more about it than the master brewer who keeps it full. Randy Hughes is brewmaster at City Brewery in La Crosse. Randy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Let's start off with the obvious question. How big is the world's largest six-pack?
Well, they're quite big. They're each individual tank or can holds 3,700 barrels of beer. So just to put that in terms that most people can understand a little easier, you're talking about 1.2 million cans worth of beer per tank.
Whoa.
That's a lot of beer.
That's a lot of beer.
So how is its number one status verified?
Well, that's a bit fuzzy. these tanks will be celebrating their 45th birthday. They were built in 1969, and there were not actually even worldwide a lot of really large tanks back then. And I'm not sure that it was actually verified, but hey, go out on the internet and Google on the world's largest six-pack, and this is what you get. So if it's on the internet, it's got to be true.
And nobody's out there challenging this claim, saying we've got a bigger six-pack.
Well, to my knowledge, nobody has, and which is a little strange. There are much bigger tanks out there. I'm just not sure that they're in six-pack form and outside and have, you know, are made up like cans. So, in fact, we have larger tanks than that. It's just that they're some of them are inside, and they don't have the logos all over them.
Well, what kind of beer are you storing in there?
Well, for most of its life, they held old-style lager. That was the primary beer, number one beer, that the G. Heilman Brewing Company produced for about 100 years. Now it can be a variety of different things, depending on what we need them for. Again, with the large capacity, it has to be enough volume to be able to fill the tank up. So it's got to be 3,000 barrels or more per brand. But at any given time, it can be anywhere from you know, one brand to six brands. But we turn them over about every month.
Do you know, back in 1969, was the plan, we're going to make storage tanks that look like a six-pack? Or did somebody make a design for storage tanks and somebody said, hey, it looks like a six-pack, we better paint those?
You know, that I actually can't tell you. They were the first very large tanks for the G. Heilman Brewing Company. They were, they would have been about five times larger than their largest tanks at the time. And they were also the first tanks west of, or east of 3rd Street that runs north-south down through La Crosse. So it was a It was a big deal at the time, but I don't know if it was designed with that purpose in mind or not, or if somebody just looked at it and said, hey, that's a six-pack. So I really can't answer that.
Rob and I were talking about them before the show started, and I asked him if they had pop tops, which, of course, we're going to ask you. And he said you couldn't drink it anyway unless you were a really big giant. So I'm guessing there's no pop tops on these, right?
Well, there's no pop tops, but they do have, you know, vents on the top, and we have what we call safeties on top of them. And there has been an occasion when they've been overfilled and had beer streaming out of the top and down the sides, but that's fortunately enough, that's pretty rare, but no pop tops.
I'm sure I'm not the first person in the world to make a Homer Simpson joke, giant beer. But suppose some ambitious person wanted to drink all the beer in there at a reasonable pace. How long do you reckon it'd take to polish that off?
A reasonable pace? What is
well,
that?
With not like constantly drinking breaks for, you know, food. That's
well,
sort of thing.
You know, and that's a good question. And actually, we've got a sign that's been out front, you know, as long as the tanks have been here, with facts on that, as far as how many cans and six packs and, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And I actually had to go out there and verify all those numbers to make sure they were true. But basically, it would provide a person with a six-pack of beer a day for 3,351 years.
Whoa.
So you're set.
So, yeah. But I do know the tour guides in the old days used to tell the tours that during Oktoberfest here in La Crosse that they used to drain the six-pack. And I always used to laugh because even in its best year, and we get, you know, hundreds of thousands of people here in La Crosse for Oktoberfest, best year ever, they probably did no more than one half of one of the cans. So
wow.
That's a lot of beer.
It's funny. I always think of Milwaukee as the big brewery city. Is La Crosse a pretty big beer city, too?
Well, originally, we were the G. Heilman Brewing Company, and we did about 5 million barrels of beer a year. So for this side of the state, we're definitely the largest existing brewery. Milwaukee, of course, used to be the beer capital of the Midwest and still is in some respects, but La Crosse is no slouch, that's for sure.
Do you know how far back La Crosse's brewing history goes?
Well, this brewery, which, of course, is now the City Brewery, goes back to 1853. Originally, when Gottlieb Heilman started brewing, the brewery itself was constructed in 1858, so about as long as La Crosse has been here in some fashion or another. So, and it's been an almost continuous operation ever since. Obviously, there was Prohibition in there. And a couple of rough year or so, or several months between the Heilman and City Brewery transition. But today we've got 500 people working here and making all kinds of beer and different products. So
is this a major tourist attraction? Do people come from all over to see this thing?
It's amazing. Even, well, in the old days, back when we ran tours and all that, we had tens of thousands of people over the course of a year on the tours, but even now, at least every week, I see people out there stopping, getting their picture taken by the world's largest six-pack, and then hopping in the car and driving away. And they're probably the most photographed beer tanks in the world, I'm guessing.
Wait, are they outside? Where are they housed?
They are outside.
They're outside.
They're obviously vertical, and they're insulated, you know, for the cold Wisconsin weathers, and boy, over the years, they've probably gone, we've probably run several million barrels of beer through those tanks.
All right, Randy, thank you so much for joining us and filling us in.
Thank you.
That's Randy Hughes. He's the brewmaster at City Brewing Company in La Crosse, where you'll find the subject of this week's Curious Wisconsin segment, the world's biggest six-pack.
And by the way, if you have got a question about Wisconsin, something that's kind of cool that you might like a little more information about, please call the Central Time hotline. It's 855-683-4444. 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422. We'd love to know what's on your mind and help you get a little more information for it and share it with everybody else.
You can also post your questions on the Central Time Facebook page. We're Central Time on WPR, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it is our Food Friday, and this week we'll talk to one of WPR's in-house foodies who has been going kind of nuts, actually, cooking lots of Meyer lemon recipes. Today we sampled some Meyer lemon ceviche, and we'll hear about that.
Right, there was ice cream. She made margaritas but didn't bring those to work, and there was something else.
Lemon bars,
right, of course, the obvious one. So looking forward to that. We'll also talk to a New York Times reporter about her article comparing Duluth and Superior, neighboring cities that have taken different paths as their state governments have gone in opposite directions. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.
Still to come after the news, Eau Claire now has the largest collection of Robert Frost works outside of the East Coast. We'll find out how UW-Eau Claire ended up with a poetic treasure trove. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Out with some beer music for you.
Let's drink, let every lover salute his sweetheart. Let's drink, Frost!
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later in the program, we'll take a look at the status of the world's large carnivores. A new study shows that their populations are on the decline, which could have serious implications for the world's ecosystems.
First, as we just heard in the news, the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire is now home to the largest collection of Robert Frost works and materials outside of the East Coast, thanks to a private donation from a Milwaukee woman.
The collection includes all kinds of work from and about the poet, and there's some rare stuff in there that's sure to attract the attention of Frost scholars and budding poets.
Later in the program, we'll talk with the Poet Laureate of Wisconsin about Frost's legacy and continuing impact in the world of poetry. First, we welcome in Greg Kokin to tell us more about this collection. Greg is head of special collections at University Archives and records management at UW-Eau Claire. Greg, welcome to Central Time.
Good afternoon, Veronica and Rob. Great to be here.
So, Greg, first off, we got to ask, as the archive guy there, are you totally geeking out about having this collection in your hands?
Oh, I think anybody would be geeking out with a collection of this stature. You know, I get to work with a lot of great rare materials, but truthfully, on a day-to-day basis, nothing comes close to what I get to work with this collection.
Well, give us the story here. How did this East Coast poet end up having this connection with someone in Wisconsin and these archives ending up here?
Well, Frederick Schmidt, who really organized this collection, began collecting first editions of American authors while he was in high school in Shorewood, Wisconsin. And he eventually went off to Dartmouth, where he met Chief Librarian Harold Rugg. And it was there that Rugg really encouraged Schmidt in his collecting and also helped encourage him to focus his collecting. And so after that, he was looking at Faulkner and Hemingway and Steinbeck and, of course, Robert Frost. And it was while he was there in 1942 that Harold Rugg introduced Schmidt to Robert Frost. And the two kind of hit it off. They started a relationship together and would often take long walks on the Dartmouth campus. And it was from there that their relationship continued to grow and his interest in Robert Frost poetry and books continued to grow as well. And then over time, the collection just became really this amazing selection of works by Robert Frost and rare items in Robert Frost's hand. And it was through some connections that we were able to meet Miss Joan Christofferson Schmidt, and we began the journey together to see this collection acquired by the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire Foundation.
And do I have this right? You already had a Robert Frost collection going there.
We did have some Robert Frost items in our collection already, some first editions of his works. Of course, nothing in comparison to what we have here in this collection now.
Well, give us a taste. What is in this collection that you're just unveiling?
Well, there's really three distinct components to this collection. There's the books authored by Robert Frost, the books which are about Robert Frost and about his poetry, and then there are those manuscript items, those rare materials that are in Frost's own hand. There's a total of 45 books authored by Robert Frost. Nearly all of those are rare first editions or limited editions. And of those, 22 are actually signed and inscribed by Robert Frost. When he would inscribe one of those books, he would frequently write a few lines of poetry inside the book. I should point out that one of the special components of that collection is a 1916 first edition copy of Frost's book Mountain Interval. It was in that book which Frost wrote his full poem One Step Backward Taken, and he dated it April 15, 1946 from Dartmouth College, New Hampshire. That poem would actually be published the next year, and as we've learned from the donor in our conversations with her, that poem was actually written about Fred Schmidt while he was in the service and his time.
It's amazing not just to have the materials, but to have the story behind them be part of the legacy here.
Absolutely, and we want to be able to share that story as well. We consider that all part of understanding this collection.
What are some of the most interesting things you've seen written, as you've mentioned, in Robert Frost's own hand as you've started to come to grips with this collection?
I think one of the most amazing things is when you get to see pages from Robert Frost's notebook and you see the original poetry that has been written in his hand. And in some of the cases, you can actually see that he's crossing off words and crossing off lines and he's rewriting components. It allows you to really see inside the mind of Robert Frost and understand his poetry on a deep level.
So really the work's in progress there.
Yeah, in a way, you get to see the process of the author.
So apart from the coolness factor of this, what is the scholarly value? What are Frost students, Frost researchers going to get when they take a gander at what you've got there?
You know, I think you can find a lot of Robert Frost poetry online. What we are able to present in this collection is the Robert Frost poetry in its original format, the way it was first published. When I look at a rare book or an item within this collection, there are a lot of factors that I'll look at. It's not just the words on the page. It's the binding style. It's the weight of the paper. It's the style of the paper. It's the way the words appear on the page. All of that is really encompassed in the poetry. And when I work with students on campus who are going to explore this collection, I want them to be able to think critically about everything that they're looking at in order to reach a deeper understanding of Robert Frost's poetry, much in the same way I've come to appreciate him more just by processing and looking at this collection.
Now that you've got all this material, I imagine you'd like to preserve it for a good long time. What are some of the challenges in taking these kind of materials and keeping them intact for generations to come?
Well, within McIntyre Library's Special Collections and Archives Department, we want to balance preservation with access. Ultimately, it's important to be able to get these materials in the hands of researchers, but equally important to preserve it so that it's around for hundreds of years. We have a climate-controlled storage facility where we maintain stable temperature and humidity year-round. And we've also been able to build custom-built phase boxes for each of the rare books in that collection. Those phase boxes will actually further protect those books. They'll already be in that great climate-controlled environment. But even some of the elements that we don't think about frequently, like dust and light, they can have a very damaging effect on materials. And those phase boxes will help protect them even further.
You mentioned preservation and access. What is access going to be like? Can anyone in the public see some of the materials, or is there just kind of scholarly access? How does that work?
No, everyone in the public is absolutely welcome to come visit us and to view this collection. Everything we have within Special Collections and Archives, well, I should say most everything we have, is open to the public. And I encourage the public to be able to take advantage of the resources that we have there.
I can tell you're very proud of having this there. What does this collection mean to UW-Eau Claire?
This is truly a signature collection for UW-Eau Claire. It helps to really mark our university as a premier institution for undergraduate learning and research. And a collection like this just builds upon that reputation and hopefully helps attract some scholars from around the world to be able to come here, explore this collection, and help them to better understand Frost as well.
And you've worked with Joan Christofferson Schmidt, who donated these materials. How important was it for her to have them stay in Wisconsin in particular?
When I first met her and we first had a conversation, that was one of the things that she made very clear. They had such a strong, her and her husband had such a strong connection with Wisconsin, and she really wanted to see this collection stay in Wisconsin. She did not want the collection to go to the highest bidder at a public auction. She really wanted it to stay in the state, and she wanted people to actually learn and utilize this collection, to appreciate the relationship between Robert Frost and Frederick Schmidt and nature. And so she was really looking for a home which would be able to encompass all of her goals and wishes. And hopefully UW-Eau Claire is going to be that home, and we can continue to honor those wishes for hundreds of years into the future.
Well, I hope I can get by for a visit sometime. Greg, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Greg Kokin. He's head of special collections at University Archives and Records Management at UW-Eau Claire.
After the break, we'll talk with the Poet Laureate of Wisconsin about the life and legacy of Robert Frost.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. We just spoke with Greg Kokin about a new collection at UW-Eau Claire of Robert Frost books and materials, and we'll pick up that conversation and talk more about the life and legacy of Robert Frost with the Poet Laureate of Wisconsin, Max Garland. He's also a professor of English at UW-Eau Claire. Max, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So what was your first reaction when you found out about this collection?
I was very excited about it. And I tried to talk everyone I could into understanding the value of having something like this and preserving it and keeping it all of together. I think when I was very young, the first thing I knew about poetry, the first thing I knew about living poetry was watching television when Robert Frost came on at the inauguration of John F. Kennedy. That's the first time I knew there was such a thing as a living poet. Mm. Frost became, really, for a lot of us, both writers, people who went into the academic world, and to the general public, sort of the living embodiment of the poet, the only really popular poet of the 20th century in many ways, and the only poet I think you could say in the 20th or maybe even now that you could be in a room anywhere and be pretty sure that someone in that room knew some poems, some lines by Frost. And so that, to me, he was my first initiation into poetry, what a poet looked like, what a poet sounded like, and what poetry was really for.
I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, we don't have to memorize poetry as much in school anymore, but back in the day, you really did. You had to have a poem or two under your belt, and these days it is most likely to be Robert Frost, maybe Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening, that people may know. What is it about his poetry, do you think, that is so accessible and that people hold so dear?
I think, for one thing, it's very descriptive. You can tell when you read a poem or hear a poem by Frost, Stopping by Woods, or even some of the longer narrative poems of his, that this is someone who observed the world very carefully. And so he uses his observation of the world, very often the natural world, but also the world of human interactions as well, in a way that helps convey what might be the deeper or the more complex emotions under whatever the subject of that poem may be. He uses colloquial speech very often. He uses what sometimes is very obvious and what sometimes is more subtle form and rhyme that we associate with poetry. And he also has layers of meaning under that. So on the surface, you realize there's something that attracts you to the poem, what it's about, the subject, the setting. But then you can read it 50 years later and you can understand that there was another level of meaning under that as well.
There's one poem in particular in this collection that's really of interest because of the new context we see it in, the new information that the collection has given us. It's called One Step Backward Taken. What can you tell us about this poem?
Yeah, it's a poem that Frost talked about many times. He talked about various motives for writing it, but it came out at a time just about the end of World War II, and it, for a lot of people, not only had a personal meaning, but had a larger cultural context, in that there was a world that very often saw itself on the brink of possible catastrophe. It was also written right at the birth of the atomic age, in which for the first time we understood that this catastrophe could not only involve nations, but the planet as well. And so that idea of one step backward taken, stepping back from the brink, became something that was important for people to contemplate. In the personal connection, the fact that Joan Christofferson Schmidt had and really kept to herself for a long time, that there was a personal narrative concerning her own husband in this poem, is also another layer to it. But I think that's the interesting thing about poetry and about Frost poetry. There are specific motives for a particular poem, but you don't even have to know those motives to understand and to relate to that poem. They have, first of all, a specificity, but then a wider circle of universal application.
One of the surprising things about this collection, I guess, first of all, that it exists at all, but then also that it was this connection, this friendship between this young man, he was a college student, and this venerable poet at Dartmouth at the time. Does that tell you anything new about Frost's character, that he had this friendship with this kid who was really not anybody important, anybody that a big poet should have bothered with?
It certainly makes you think about the small connections in a life that may have long, long implications. I know as a teacher and as a writer, sometimes you feel that, you know, you don't see the results of your influence. You think that, you know, you talk about poetry, you read poems, and sometimes you wonder about the importance of it. But thinking about this many, many years later, what this meant to this young man and why someone of Frost's stature took the time to talk to and befriend someone from whom he had nothing to gain is also, yes, it does give me insight into Frost, because Frost, among other things, was very, very cognizant of his reputation. His image in the public was something that he worked on and calculated. To his prime in the age of television, the first, you know, major poet to do so. And so that was something that was a concern to him. So it's interesting to me to know that there was also this private side that he could not have known would have a larger legacy.
Well, while Frost's poems aren't about Wisconsin per se, there are connections that you can make between his work and Wisconsin ideas of conservation, sustainability, interest in the environment, the kind of thing championed by Aldo Leopold. Can you tease that out for us a little bit, that connection?
Well, I know during the part of the earlier interview with Greg, one of the first things that was said was, how did the poems of this New England poet, this Northeastern poet, you know, get to be here, this collection? And while that is an image we associate with Frost, Frost was born in San Francisco. He taught in Michigan. He lived for a time in Florida, and he had his first books published while he lived in England. He is a quintessentially American poet. And I think reading the New England poems, the snow poems, the spring poems, the after apple picking poem of Frost, it doesn't take a great leap for those of us in Wisconsin to relate to those poems. And I think Aldo Leopold is a good name to bring up here too, because one of the things that Frost observed very carefully and looked at with not only a sentimental and not only positive emotional way, but with a cold eye, he looked at the natural world and he observed it and he drew from it human lessons and human wisdom in the same way that Leopold did.
Now, in the story about this collection, you described Robert Frost as a poet of the people. And when I think about his poetry, I don't know nearly as much about it as you do, but I think about the natural world, the aspects of him observing the world around, and they don't always involve people. So why is he a poet of the people?
Well, you know, that's something interesting. In an interview with Frost that I read recently, he was asked a question something like this, and he claimed that there were only two of his poems that didn't have people in them. Now, I haven't gone back over all of Frost to see if that's true or not, because Frost also was very contradictory and somewhat pugnacious uh-huh. in some of his interviews. So I'm not sure about that. But when you do look at them, if it's there are even the implications in something like Stopping by Woods. He thinks about staying in that woods, but there are promises to keep at the end of it that draw him back, by implication, promises to people. And a lot of those poems that we think are all about nature, there's also an implication of a human community hovering in the background.
In the poetry world, there has been a lot that has happened since Robert Frost. Lots of different styles have become popular, and we've seen different poets rise to national consciousness. In that context, how important is he today?
I think he's very important today. He is a poet that became a popular poet. He sort of stands for, he has an image of someone we can point to as having a role as an artist in the culture, in the society itself. We have ways of judging the value and the heritage of a culture, of a state, of a nation. Frost and someone with a public stature in the arts like that reminds us that it's not just the economic clout of a state, it's not just the military clout of a nation, but it's also the content of the character and the depth of insight of those of the people within that state. And I think having an artist with a national voice such as Frost is a good reminder of that. Also, the natural world that he observed so closely and drew wisdom from is still with us. It is still something that we are interdependent upon. And again, our own Aldo Leopold talked about that community. And I think we have not drawn all of the lessons and all of the wisdom and from nature that are there to be drawn.
In the collection that is now at UW-Eau Claire, it's not just the poetry in the first editions, it's handwritten notes and some cards that Robert Frost wrote to Fritz, his friend here in Wisconsin. Have you learned anything new about his poetic voice or even just the way he thinks about the world or about poetry based on some of those handwritten notes?
Well, what I've learned so far, and I haven't spent as much time as I want to spend with the collection myself, but what I've learned is how consciously and how seriously he took the role of poet as really his. I mean, he did some farming, he did some teaching, but a poet was his calling and his vocation, and he took that very seriously, whether it was sending out holiday cards in limited editions signed with small poems or pieces of poems on them, keeping track of the various editions of his own poetry. He really took it as a calling, and he was a poet in his private interactions, in his wider public role, and you know, that to me is very interesting.
As we wind up this interview, we talked earlier about quoting poetry and how, you know, lots of people still know some Robert Frost. Do you have some favorite lines of Robert Frost that you'd be willing to share with us before you go?
Wow. I should have brought a book with me. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. My little horse must think it queer to stop without a farmhouse near. He gives his harness bells a shake to ask if there is some mistake. The only other sounds, the sweep of easy wind and downy flake. The woods are lovely, dark, and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep and miles to go before I sleep.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you. And those miles, some of them ended up at UW-Eau Claire. Thank you so much for joining us, Max.
Thanks for putting me on the spot.
You did beautifully. Max Garland is the Poet Laureate of Wisconsin. He's also a professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire.
Coming up next, we'll take a look at a new study that shows large carnivore populations are on the decline. We'll find out why that could have serious implications for the world's ecosystems. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.